So last week I was talking about flow of amorphous solids, but the particle was soft. And we think, some people disagree, but we think that when particles are hard, it's about geometry and that the physics is very different. So if you look around you, as you know, many materials around you are amorphous. I'm interested in particular in materials made of particles, many examples, and in all those materials, there is a challenge in understanding the solid phase, the liquid phase, and what's especially challenging is to understand the transition between the two. And here I want to focus on the case where I don't have any temperature at all, and I have hard particles, so undeformable particles. So for example, grains or non-buoyant suspensions. So in my title I told you I was also going to talk about inertial granular flows, but I decided I won't have time to do this, so I will be happy to talk about it later on. So really the goal ultimately for us is to be able to say something about dense flows. And the point of view we take on dense flows is to try to think about them as a sort of perturbation around the solid. And so during most of the talk, I would be in fact talking about the solid. So the question that interests me is, you know, geometrical at some level. It's how particles can flow when there is crowding, when the system is very dense. Okay, so that's a question that's central also to another transition, the glass transition, where you have particles, and when you lower the temperatures, they have less and less room to jiggle around, and at some point they freeze into some amorphous solid, a liquid that cannot flow. In dense granular flows, I think there are key difference between those two problems. But in dense granular flows, you face the same problem of crowding. And interestingly, in the two cases, when you approach the solid phase from the fluid phase, what you find is that flow occurs, but the sort of strategy that the particle takes to flow is to flow in a very collective way. So in the case of dense granular flows, the control parameter can be the packing fraction phi, the volume occupied by the particles. And if phi is small, you'll dilute, but you can increase phi until some critical packing fraction where actually you create a solid. So I'm interested in flow as we approach this point.
Are you only considering frictionless particles?
Well, those experiments are frictional particles. Yeah. But you will see that in my model, indeed, I will, during this talk, then I will mostly consider ideal system. And I would like to have a discussion just on how it's complicated enough, and then at the end we can talk about real systems. But here, those are real systems, okay? So those are Poulikin's data where he's looking at inclined planes from the top and he's looking at the particle flowing. And by changing the angle, you can change essentially the density, and you find that if you dilute, the velocity of the particle, that's the velocity field, is not correlated in space, but as you approach this point, you find big eddies that appear. More and more correlation.
But this is the top of the heat.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it's at the top of.
This is looking down on the free surface.
Yeah. All right, so one question is what is actually controlling this length scale? So I like this movie, I show it very often, so that's from Ada and Lerner. But it, for in our group, so essentially we will be interested also in the case where your particles are floating in some fluid, so you have no inertia at all. And that's a simple model of this, and you see that you have a small change of packing fraction, but a very drastic change of behavior. What you see in black here are the contact forces between particles, colors, particle sizes. So two things to notice. One is that this is already percolated, so this jamming transition has nothing to do with simple percolation. And the other aspect is that visually you can see that you have a grain length scale just by looking locally.
Isn't it essential that you have two types of particles?
Well, in 2D it's useful, otherwise they crystallize. In 3D it's less stringent.
Are the force chains simply not shown at the smaller packing fraction? Or
No, they are to scale. So it's just that the force. So here you're fixing the packing fraction and you're changing the strain rate.
Yeah.
Because the viscosity is much larger here.
Yeah.
The stress is much larger.
So actually,
this is to scale. Yes. So the stress. You have an explosion of stress.
Stress.
So the viscosity.
But the white lines are still the contact force.
Are still the contact force.
But they're just not heavy enough to be.
Oh, but they are there, but I mean, yes. Yeah, they are smaller, because the force scale is smaller. Okay, so what is this growing length scale? In fact, this talk, we thought a lot about length scale, and I won't talk much about the correlation length, actually. I will talk more about this explosion of the viscosity. So that's one case we like to think about where there are particles are non-Brownian, so temperature is irrelevant, and you are embedded in a viscous fluid. And then you can show just from dimensional analysis that your system will have a well-defined viscosity, that the shear stress is proportional to strain rate. That's just because it's the only stress scale you have in the problem, if your particles are infinitely hard and you don't have any temperature. So you can ask then, what is the viscosity as you change the packing fraction? And as you know, that's something that was looked at by Einstein in the dilute regime. He looked at the perturbation of the viscosity of the suspension when you increase the packing fraction. So this would be the viscosity, and that would be the packing fraction. So Einstein would be there, and here we're interested instead in what happens at larger packing fraction. Right, and so what you find is that your viscosity appears to explode, to diverge as you reach this critical state, which I call phi c here, and you have some exponent, and I will review maybe at the end of the talk this exponent that they found, but these are the typical value that are found. So again, in the literature to understand suspensions, there's been a lot of work where they actually tried to do some expansion in small packing fraction, the dilute limit. And here instead we want to think about it from the solid. Okay. So why is it complicated to think about the solid? It's just because this is a glass, right? So you don't have any thermal equilibrium. And if you think about a pile of sand, you have an exponential number of possible metastable states that. Should we shut the door? So there is an exponential number of metastable states in which the system can lie. So if you want to do a statistic description of the solid, you have to say something about how those states are sampled. And there is one approach to this problem that was discussed last week, which is Edwards' assumption, essentially that you have some kind of democratic sampling. The assumption that maybe it's not a too bad approximation to assume that at fixed volumes, the states that you find will be occupied with a similar probability. Okay, I'm simplifying, but essentially this. So here I want to take a sort of transverse point of view that may not contradict with Edwards, but I think it's a different starting point. And this is the idea that maybe the states that you actually visit have something that's very special. And I will comment on what I mean by special in next slide. So I will argue that indeed for simple models of granular materials at least, the states that you visit are special. And let me try to phrase it by a question, which is the following. If you prepare a pile of sand, does solid sand remember that it had to flow just before it jammed? Okay, so what I mean is that any configuration that you generate must have had a kinetic pathway that led to it. Is it a stringent constraint on the system or not? So I like to use this very sketchy, naive diagram to think about this problem. So that you could find many difficulties with this diagram. So imagine that the phase space is organized in a very simple way. So this would be a sort of scenario where this idea may be useful. Imagine that you can nicely separate configurations that are flowing and configurations that are jammed. So maybe if you prepare your system in a flowing configuration and you stop tapping and you don't have any temperature, but it's dissipative, so the system is going to relax. And if you don't have any tapping, then you may expect that as you reach stable state, you're going to jam. So in this scenario, you don't explore really all states, you only explore those states that live on this line. And this scenario, I will refer to it as marginal stability. I will try to define this notion maybe more precisely below. Yes? No, I mean, you prepare and you have unstable configurations, sets that live, you know, that are unstable, that have unstable modes. I mean, we'll talk about what are the excitations that are relevant here. So I think this sort of night picture will get more concrete when I give you examples with what I mean by the axis.
Talk more about what you actually mean by stability, I guess.
Yes, I will talk more about that.
What is the axis?
What are the axis? So I will give you examples. So I would rather have this discussion once when it becomes more concrete. Although I can try to make it a bit more concrete with those two examples here.
You mentioned two references there. You know about Sue Coppersmith and Peter
Lee. You told me about. We discussed. There's something I think different.
This is more connected.
So, all right. So if a scenario like that holds, which is not trivial at all, because there are many things that could go wrong with a simple picture like this. Then you learn a lot, because you learn that instead of living on a plane, you live on the line, so it tells you something about sampling. And it also tells you something about dynamics, because if you live on this line, if you give a small kick, then you're very close to flowing configuration, and so you may expect to have some kind of rich dynamics. So the sort of idea I have in mind here has been really come from those fields. I mean, I think the first really work on this is from Coulomb glasses, the work of Efrosh and Shklovsky. So Coulomb glasses, you have dirty insulators where electrons are localized. And what Efrosh and Shklovsky have shown is the fact that if you take an electron and you move it to another localized, unoccupied state, requiring that such move is stable is actually constraining on the system, that the density of state at the Fermi level has to vanish at least quadratically. And what experiments support is that these bounds, we have a bound on stability, and it appears that the bound is actually saturated. Okay, so this is what I have in mind in some sense, that you look at some specific excitation in your system, and that gives stringent constraint on where the system can lie, and you find that those constraints are actually saturated.
So their bound works for all the jam states? Or just for the ones on the bound?
You mean Efrosh and Shklovsky?
Yeah.
So what they say is that the density of state has to vanish quadratically.
For all the jam states.
Well, the bound lies always, and on the boundary, it's saturated.
The boundary is saturated, yeah. Okay, so the question then is, what are actually the excitation I have in mind when I'm thinking about a packing of particles? And first I would like to just mention the model, and I'm going to look at very simple models, so at the end of the talk we can have a big discussion on their relevance. But so far in this talk I will mostly focus on those. I will think about spheres and they will be frictionless. Okay, so clearly, very ideal system, you could think about emulsion that will not have that friction when there is very low pressure or something. So numerically, you can generate the states in many ways. So for example, you have soft particles, you quench them at infinite temperature, and then you lower the packing fraction until you reach a point where the particles just touch. And there's been a lot of work in the last decade on this problem, how elasticity behaves as you approach this point from above. Here in this talk, I will talk about the solid, which is really what happens at this point. So there is something that's well known, and that has to do with an old result by Maxwell, but that's very important for us. It is about the coordination. So how many contacts particles have? And it turned out that this number is actually well defined. So you look at particles, and you look how many exact contacts they have, and the coordination is the mean number of contacts that they have. And what you find is that Z is exactly twice the spatial dimension. So it would be 6 in 3D, for example. So the idea that, in some sense, contacts are putting constraint on the motion of the particles. And you have a certain number of constraints, and you have a certain number of degrees of freedom. The number of degrees of freedom is the number of collective modes of the particles, and it's just the number of particles times the spatial dimension. So Maxwell, who was thinking about the stability of engineering structure, said that if you don't have enough constraints, the system would flow. And so, for example, your packing would not be stable. So the coordination must at least be that. Now, if the coordination was too large, what those authors have argued is that you also have a constraint that particles that are in contact have to touch, but to touch exactly. So their distance has to be equal to their diameter. You have also a certain number of equations like that, which is equal to the number of contact, and again, a certain number of degrees of freedom, the number of displacement field. So those authors have argued that if you had more contact than this, then the particle would need to overlap. So in fact, you lie in a state where you just have enough contact to be mechanically stable, and that's called isostatic. So one notion I will use is that if you break a contact and you push two particles, then you have one degree of freedom, which is going to be collective. Particles are going to move actually in the entire system. But you will have one, only one, because there's only one contact that opens. Right, so that's well understood. Now let me go to what was not understood. And one aspect is about forces. So something that was looked at early on, that's already 20 years back in granular systems, is actually the distribution of contact forces between particles. So for example, you could look at the, try to estimate from this picture, I mean, there are many other methods, try to estimate what is the distribution of amplitude of force that contacts. Are exchanged, the particles are exchanging. And you can plot this. Okay. So the way people have been thinking about force in packings is typically you think about some kind of frozen disorder. And then you apply force as the boundary, and then you describe some kind of scattering of those forces on the disorder. And you try to get, for example, a distribution of forces like this. So one aspect is that when you do that, you can actually predict what will be the distribution of forces at small force. But what all those models have predicted is that this will grow as the contact force to some power n, where n is some integer. So what we realized, first in anisotropic system, and then that was also checked by Charbonneau and co-workers in isotropic system, is that actually that's not the case. So there is a non-trivial exponent that describes the low tail of the distribution of force. Okay, so for this quantity, for example, we find an exponent that's close to what, order 18. So at that stage, that's a mystery because those models cannot generate this, yes?
So this is always close to isostaticity, right?
Yes. So I'm looking only at jam states around. But it's, yeah, one trying to say, maybe the statement that we find the same exponent if it's anisotropic or isotropic. So then there is another quantity that's looked at a lot in liquids, which has to do with the pair distribution function, at which distance particles lie. And here, in particular, we're interested in the gap between particles. What is the distribution of those gaps? And you find something very surprising. You find that in those packings, okay, so you have a certain number of particles that are touching, but you have many particles that are almost touching, but not touching. So this quantity here has actually a singularity when the gap goes to zero, with some exponents that close to 0.4, looked at by various authors. Okay? So many particles are almost touching, but actually not quite.
Yes. Sorry, the exponent for the small forces from the previous slide, does that depend on whether it's isostatic or in shear? Or it's a universal exponent?
Okay, so what I meant by So a lot to tell you. If you look in an isotropic, isostatic system, you get this exponent. Uh-huh. If you look at the critical stress anisotropy where it flows, you get the same exponent. Uh-huh. If you look in flow, I will discuss flow later on, but you will have a cutoff at small force, and then you recover this P of F, and then the scale of this cutoff is changing. And since it's a conference on avalanches, I also have to say that there is some weird cracking noise in this system. And the work that was done more than a long time ago. So what those authors looked at is, for example, in 2D, you have a packing of, in this case, disks, of hard disks, and you confine them in a box, and you push on the walls, and you have a force on the, on this wall, which is F1, and a force on this wall, which is F2. And initially, say you prepare your system at, you know, at some pressure, so those two forces are equal. But then you're going to increase F2. So you can define, for example, a sort of stress anisotropy, something like this. And those authors have looked at what happens as you increase the stress anisotropy. And what they monitor is the change of shape of the box. So in particular, this length is going to change, and you measure how it changes in relative terms, so the strain in this direction. And what you find? What you find is that there are periods where actually nothing is going on, and that makes sense because those particles are infinitely hard, okay? So they are not going to move elastically. So nothing is going on, and then at some point, some forces in the packing are going to become negative, some contacts will open, and it will trigger some rearrangements. And those rearrangements turn out actually to be poor or low distributed. So we have small one and very large one. And they looked at the exponent, and it's close to an exponent 1.46, which they found. So you have crackling, but that's different from the self-organized criticality of depinning, for example. So in depinning, you have some kind of, you have crackling. If you put the, if you impose a force on your elastic velocity on the elastic manifold that's much smaller than the characteristic velocity, the system would spontaneously sit at a critical force Fc, and you will have crackling. But if you are imposing the force, you would have only really one field where you actually find cracking. Here it's different, so I think it's useful to classify the system differently. Here you will have crackling in an entire region, right? Even much before you flow. So this scenario will...
So mu star is like you're eating.
So mu star is, yeah, at some point, the frictionless particles, at some point, they will flow. So you'll have a liquid. Mm-hmm. You would flow, but in the entire solid phase, you crack.
In the entire solid phase, you have a power law without a cutoff. Or the cutoff, it grows.
Or yeah, without a cutoff, if you had a very large system. You have system spanning avalanches. You have system spanning avalanches.
And do you have a cutoff on the distribution when you are far below the?
No, so precisely that's the point.
Yeah.
That you always find avalanches.
Then
yes, they don't have a cutoff that would diverge here, right? You never see that. So, actually, we have an argument with Marcus to explain why it has to be like this.
Even at 0 plus?
Yeah.
Because contacts can break, right? At very, very small.
Well, I think Marcus told you a bit about why it's like this, but I mean, I don't know if I have it. That has to do with this margin stability that you have. Once you have this, you can show that you must have system spanning avalanches. So, I mean, I could talk about it again at the end of the talk. I would just mention, I mean, the result is not. Okay, so now let's go to our argument. And we're going to look at the same setup. So you look at the packing of particles in a box. So you have some, you think about walls confining your system. And because particles are completely hard, there is no energy in the relevant quantity is the work of external forces, so PV. So the system wants to minimize its volume.
How do you find, did you find a pressure in the hard part of the system?
the pressure you just set up to, it gives you your scale of force. If you have infinitely hard particles, the pressure you prescribe, it just gives a scale to the forces you have.
But for completely hard particles, isn't there no scale?
So precisely, so that's why the only scale is the pressure. So if you want, if you take this packing and you multiply the pressure by 2, the only thing that's going to happen is that all the forces are going to be together. Okay. But so that can be generalized if you're anisotropic, that would be the work of external forces that would have a shear term. Okay. So the system wants to minimize this, the volume. And so the game we're playing is we want to think about the stability of a packing, and we want to ask the following question. Can I rearrange a packing, maybe change the contact network, who is in contact with whom, and lower the volume of the packing? In a stable packing, it should be hard to do that. Okay. So what? Those are the excitation we are going to look at. So we're going to look at a system like this, with some pressure at the boundary, and we take a contact and we push on it. If you count degrees of freedom, you find that if you push on it, there will be only one collective, you break one contact, you will only have one collective move where the particle can move. And this collective, and I include as degree of freedom the size of the box. So the box in general is going to dilate initially. Then we'll have to discuss if it dilates or contracts, but it will change form. Okay, so I look, I take two particles, I push them apart. All the particles are going to move in the system. It's a collected mode, floppy mode or soft mode. Okay. So my excitation is really, I take two particles, I push them apart, I open one contact, but at some point, I will close another contact elsewhere in the system. So my excitation, if you want, is corresponds to opening one contact and closing another one. It's like taking an electron and putting it somewhere else, or flipping
even
to spin.
Even if you let the box expand.
Sorry?
Even if you let the box expand.
So the box, so you need to let the box expand to have to have
this. Then is it always necessary to close another contact?
No, if you just take two particles and push them apart,
yeah.
To be allowed to do that, you need to have the, otherwise you won't be able to move the box. And what's going to happen is that all those particles move, and at some point you'll have another contact.
But how do you know that?
Well, just geometrically, you have all those, particles that are, you know, flowing around, and at some point.
Why can't I think of just the box expanding a little bit?
So the box is going to
have a number of contacts.
So the box is
all nonlinear, right?
Sorry?
It's all nonlinear. You're talking about.
I will talk. Yeah, nonlinearities are going to be important too. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, conceptually, if you get into the pin phase, then it starts flowing.
Flow, yeah, we'll talk about flow. But I mean, if you just push two particles, imagine that all those particles are going to move like this. This is actually an example. This is a sort of displacement field. And so very early on, in fact, you're going to create another contact elsewhere. In fact, the distance at which you can push those two particles vanish very rapidly with the system size. It's a very small number. Immediately you're going to make another contact.
And I'm just asking, is this rigorous? Or like an epsilon opening?
Well, again, we'll discuss about the scaling and how exactly it vanishes with this.
The system's under pressure, and so if there's not, if it's not got enough contacts, it'll crack until it dies.
Okay, so there's another question, which is, okay. The game I'm playing here is purely geometrical. I'm pushing two particles, and I'm imposing that all the other particles stay close. Then I'm going to create a new contact. Now there's another question, which is the new state that I generated, is it stable or not? Is the dynamic wants to continue or not? But that's a separate question, and we'll discuss this too. But here I just want to build a necessary condition for stability. And a necessary condition is that I define, there's a well-defined path in phase space going along this mode, so I open one contact and all the others stay closed. I have this well-defined path in phase space, and what I want to require for stability, a necessary condition of stability, is that along this path, the volume is always larger than the initial. Okay, so that's just a necessary condition. I have one well-defined path in phase space, and I can go.
Is it always possible to open some contact in the middle of the system such that all other contacts are in the same?
Yes, so that has to do with this isostatic business I told you about, that if you count degrees of freedom at the linear level, you always have one possible mode where you can actually push two particles apart. But actually, very early on, you will have to stop. All right, so this is my criterion for stability, that the volume has to grow along the way. Okay, so if you look at this numerically and not really going to justify it, I mean, this is done in this paper, but what you find is that if you push two particles, in general, the sort of, if you take a random contact, you will find that typically they are like this, the floppy modes. That is, it's a collective displacement field. Actually, you don't have any decay of the displacement field with distance. You can show that in isostatic material, it's not like normal elasticity, you don't have a power law decay of the displacement. But if you look at very small forces, so you condition to look at those floppy modes associated to contacts that are at very low forces, then you find that you have two kind of objects. You still have some objects that are like this, but you also find some objects that are actually very localized. So what I mean is that if you move those two particles, a few particles would move a lot, and then you would have a small background of motion that's not decaying with distance, but which is actually much smaller than the displacement here. Those guys, so you can understand why you have such local modes. It's because it's easy to build example of local configuration, where if you push two particles, they will not couple much to the surrounding. So for example, imagine I have those six particles. I don't know if you see, I have some angle here. If those angles were close to 90 degrees, if I was opening this contact, the displacement of those with respect to those two I pushed would be very small. Okay? So you can build local configuration like that. It turned out that those guys couple very little to the stress at the boundary, because even a big force here is going to lead to a tiny force there. So that's why those guys end up showing up at small forces. Okay, so they are there. And so numerically, you can look at both those guys and those guys, and you can actually measure the density. That is, at a given force, how many of those do I find versus how many of those? Yes?
Maybe I'm still confused, but how do you get low and high forces if you have rigid hard particles?
I don't know what to, I mean, what do you mean?
If I have hard particles that have either infinite or zero force.
No. The strength goes to zero, but not the force.
The overlap is zero, energy is zero.
Yes, yeah, so it's nothing tangular in terms of forces, if you take the limit of infinity stiffness. Strength goes to zero, but not the force. All right, so something I'm putting under the carpet is that, in fact, you have a continuum between those two. And in this paper, we actually give the argument for to describe this continuum. But in terms of scaling, it's the scaling argument assuming that I have two types give you the correct answer, and that's one argument I can give in the talk, so that's what I'm going to do. So, yes?
Do you have to be particularly close to isostaticity to observe this kind of stuff?
So it seems that I'm always asked this question, I always give the same answer. So, yes, everything I'm going to say is for isostatic system, okay. And what happens in other systems, that's, I can. So if you had soft particles and you would compress them, you would find a scaling, again, P of F would have two scaling regimes, and I mean, yeah, we can, but first let me try to pass this message through in this simple case, and we'll see how we move from. So you can actually measure two exponents, one characterizing how many of those guys you have, and another one characterizing how many of those guys you have. Okay? And we find such numbers. Now the contention is that this notion of marginal stability is actually going to freeze what those two numbers are. That it's, those numbers are fixed by marginal stability. Same concept that I mentioned for Coulomb glasses and so on. So here, I mean, it's threatened to be a few slides to derive this, but I think it's very natural. So I'm going to give you the argument only for the extended contact. You have two kinds of excitation, and you can do stability argument with respect to the two. Here I'm only going to look at the extended ones. What happens to the volume if I take those guys and I push them apart? S is, remember how much I push those two particles apart. Delta V is the change of volume of the box, P is the pressure. F12 is the force in the contact I'm pushing. At linear order, maybe unsurprisingly, you find that if you want the work of external forces is equal to work of contact forces. So the change of volume is always positive and is proportional to the contact force. This result here at the linear level simply reflects force balance. You know, force balance, you can write it as a virtual work theorem telling you that for any displacement that you can think of, the work of external forces is equal to the work of contact forces. For my floppy mode, no contact work except the one I open. And it works by how much you open it times the force. And here I have the work of external forces. So this first part here is really simply force balance. All right. Then you have a second order term. And the second order term obviously is quadratic in S. But it plays a very important role because it's extensive in N. And it has a very simple geometrical interpretation. If you are going straight along your floppy mode, not it's going to bend actually the floppy mode, but if you are going straight along it, the only thing that particle could do is to have transverse motion. So they cannot, you know, go toward each other. So they can only move transversely. If you move like this, at second order, just because of Pythagoras' theorem, at second order, you're going to create a little gap between those two particles. And this gap is proportional then to the displacement squared, to S squared. So you're going to create gaps everywhere in the system because your mode is extended. And therefore, what it means is that you can compress your system. You benefit from all those gaps and you can compress your system. You can compute this term and it's just scale like this, right? But it's just this effect, this geometrical effect that at second order you always tend to increase the distance, so that allows you to compress further. Any questions? So what you see is that it's not obvious who is going to win. And in fact, there are two scenarios. So this is, again, this change of volume. So this is an inverse parabola. The slope is always positive. So this is S, how much I move those two particles apart. This is the change of volume. And you find that there is always a positive slope because the force in the contact are positive. So this is just the force in the contact. But then it's always bending negatively, which means that if you could push your two particles away from each other sufficiently, you will always destabilize eventually. But there is something that actually can prevent you to do that, is that at some point you're going to hit a wall. And the wall is that elsewhere in the system, you create a new contact. And this is this wall here. So my notation of S star would be, you know, the gap at which you would become unstable, and SC is when you create a new contact elsewhere. So the race that's going on is that stability requires that SC is actually smaller than S star. Otherwise, this is unstable, you can create a tensor value.
Is there something wrong in creating the tensor system?
Okay, I will. So what you find is that, yes, I will comment on that. You will find that we get scaling, this criterion gives you scaling relations. If they are not satisfied, if you are unstable, what you would show is that it would not stop here. It would trigger an extensive rearrangement in the entire system. Right. So now you can extract scaling scaling behavior from this because you can estimate the two quantities. Right, so this quantity SC, remember that's when you're going to form your first contact. And remember that those extended modes, all the particles are moving by something of order S. So the first contact will occur when the motion of the particles is of order of the minimal gap in the system. That is, the two particles that were the closest but not touching. When you reach this kind of scale, then you start to create contact. Okay. So SC is going to go like H mean, and we know the distribution of H. So we're going to assume that those gaps are independent. And if those are independent, you can use external value statistics to know the scaling of the minimal variable if you have n independent variable with such distribution. Okay? So then you get that this minimal gap has a non-trivial dependence with n. So from the slide before, you can also estimate S star. And it was just, it's related to this slope, f mean divided by n. And again, you're going to assume that the contact force are independent. And so you're going to apply your argument to the minimal force on the system. So you're going to look at the contact which was carrying the minimal force, and you try to open this one. And you try to see if this one is stable or not. So maybe I should say at a qualitative level, what start by saying what is going to be the answer. Well, in a packing where you have many small forces, it's more likely to be unstable because you can look, you can find forces that are almost zero. So the packing which has many small forces is more likely to be unstable. And the fact that you have pseudo gap in P of F reflects this because the system wants to stabilize and get rid of the small forces. On the other hand, a system in which it's very easy to make new contacts, there's a big divergence in G of H, will be the opposite, will be more stable. Okay, so this scaling argument illustrates this, so you have to compare those two. SC goes like H mean, and now this S star from the previous slide is just the force divided by N. Now I'm going to look at the argument for the smallest force, and you find that it has a scaling dependence with N. So then we argue that to be stable, what you want is that in the thermodynamic limit, as I said, SC has to be smaller than S star. And if you compare those two expressions, that's only possible if this exponent gamma is larger than 1 over 2 plus theta e.
And this is the theta associated with the extended modes?
Yeah. All right, so, then this was the inequality we derived, and then we could look numerically. I told you gamma is close to 0.4, theta e is close to 0.44, and so the values we find numerically are actually consistent with the saturation of those bounds. So it seems that the packing of hard particles find configurations that are stable, but just stable with respect to this. You can do a similar argument for the localized object, for the localized excitation, and again you find now a different inequality, and again you find that numerically it appears to be saturated. We looked at 2D and 3D. Okay. And we looked at.
Okay, this is for a specific way of preparing systems. I mean, if you just pour some.
No, that by tapping, okay, so now you're bringing me to again friction and so on, so I will talk about friction at the end of the talk. Not take a question on it now. And tell you why I think this concept may still be useful for frictional systems. But it's true for really the same where you have friction, you have all those stuff. Now you could ask the same question for those hard frictionless system. Is it the case that those exponents depend on system preparation? And what we found is that at least when we do it, it does not. when we do it, it did not. When Charbonneau and others did it, initially it was depending on system preparation. But now it's not depending on system preparation for them either. So also there, okay, we'll come to this. So I think the sort of growing consensus is that it's not dependent. So the two preparations that have been done is swelling particles or decompressing them. Seems to give you the same. Not obvious of the word.
Do you expect movements of multiple breaking contacts?
I will talk about this.
Okay.
I think it's, yeah, this is the next slide.
Sorry, this is the same exponent that was controlling all of the old arguments about the value of the modulus because of the excess contacts, no? The gamma. This is the PDF of the gaps. PDF of the gaps, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What modulus?
So before, so in all the arguments about the, you know, the rigidity length and whatnot, right? This was supposed to be 0.5. Yes.
Okay. So let me. Right. So okay. So there was. Right. So in the literature, that makes me a bit aware of what I want to do. But there is a debate between is this 0.5, 0.4, and the small dimensions that seems to depend if you include the radius or not. Uh-huh. So the way we measure it now is by, which is I think the correct way for stability, is to have the radius fall into the cave with some kind of gravity, uh-huh. and count the gap with respect to that. So then that's really because a radius at fault, if now if it makes a contact, it will contribute to stabilizing the system.
Okay.
Now there is another, okay, so there is another debate about.
So if you do include the radius, it's 0.5, is that what you're saying?
Or is that just a numerical statement? But if you don't, you get 0.4. So I think in terms of the data, I think the literature has converged. Now, you're going to another question, which is, I think, related to stability when you have soft particles and you compress and so on. So I can come back to you, but the argument is, if you think about soft particles, you also have stability argument about vibration modes, and that gives you a delta z that grows like, in fact, the square root of phi minus phi c. That's what we derive this term.
Which would be the.
And that's also found. So the, indeed, the scaling of delta z versus phi goes like phi minus phi c to square root. So what's wrong with the argument that says that you can go from one to the other? Uh-huh. But not the argument that we've done, which are on stability and that just derive a bound of stability. Okay, so there is a question of why is it marginally stable? And really, I think the good answer to that is in this paper. And here it's just a sort of end-weaving argument that I had at the time, but we use, in fact, this argument there. So so you can look at two cases. So you have this stability constraint for the weakest contact to be stable. And you could ask, yes, but why does the system care about having its weakest contact stable or not? And in fact, it has to do with the fact that if the weakest contact was, in fact, unstable, you can show this, I think, was argued correctly, that you would actually trigger a giant rearrangement in the system if this is violated. So let me try to explain you intuitively why. Let's assume that we don't satisfy the bound.
So gamma here is the exponent, or is
the gamma is the exponent of g of h.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Sorry, it's just my scaling relations that satisfy. So I told you that stability had to be, gamma had to be larger than this. Okay. Now let me discuss the case where it's not so. Imagine that I would not satisfy that, and I look at the thermodynamics, a very, very large system then, and I open those two guys. And then I create a new contact elsewhere in the system. Okay?
It can be everywhere? Or?
It can be everywhere because the modes are extended there. Yeah. So it's actually true also for the localized modes. They make contact in the background. So what would happen, what you find, is that if the bound is saturated, is violated, it means actually that this scale SC is much larger than S star. So when N grows larger, you have, your curve will be very asymmetric like that. And what it means in particular is that when you make a new contact, this slope would be much, much, much larger than the initial slope there. Okay. This slope reflects the contact force in the contact. In the contact you started with or in the contact you ended up with, right? So if you violate the stability condition I told you about, what would happen is that in the new contact that you form, you must have a very large force compared to the minimal force in your system. Now, this very large force that you create is like a dipole that you would put in the system, and we're going to rearrange all the forces elsewhere. In an isostatic system, you can show that if you put a dipole of amplitude delta F, actually you change all the contact forces in the system by something of order delta. So in some sense, what you would be doing is giving a giant kick in the system compared to the characteristic minimal force in it. So it means that all the forces that are at that scale, the smaller force in the system, due to this kick, they will actually open. Okay. And because they will open, then you will have, you know, an so they will open, which in turn will open many more contacts, so it will just completely explode. So in fact, the stability argument I gave you is also characterized as sort of avalanches, that if it was not satisfied, you would have giant avalanches in the system. If it was strictly stable, then at best, if you were imposing forces at the boundary to trigger instabilities, one contact force would go to zero. The dynamic would be boring. It would just be one, things would take place one by one. Okay? So here you don't have any avalanches in some sense. So in the cartoonish picture, if you want, is that this is a phase diagram where, that's theta E. And here we're saying, essentially, you would have extensive avalanche. Here you would have no avalanche at all. So if you prepare the system here, the dynamics is going to lead it to this line, and then it's going to stop. Okay, so that's a sort of end-waving argument. What we've shown with Marcus is that, and I think he told you about this, so, is that for specific dynamics, you can prove that you must have cracking. And that proves, therefore, that you must live on this. Yes?
If I start from the other side, the no avalanches side, would
all right,
I
so
end up on that line?
Okay, so there's also a sort of not obvious question in all two systems, which is, and our result with Marcus tells nothing about this, which is, are there really states here or not, right? And we have a dynamical argument, but it does not answer this question of, do you think that there are much more stable states or not? If there are much more stable states, then our argument is very different from Edward's assumption. Mm-hmm. If there are no states over there, then it could be the same. So I think that it's a tough question, but I think for electron glasses, it's not understood, for example. I think it's a subtle question here too. My take would be that if you're allowed to have crystalline regions and to pack crystals and to have disorder around, then I think you will have plenty of much more stable states. And so I think the good way to think about it is dynamic. It's dynamic.
Another quick question or two?
Yeah.
Would by changing friction, would I be able to change this gamma beta relationship? Is that what you expect?
I would tell you about friction. I have a slide on friction, why I think this is, there is some hope. Okay, so let me, every time you see theta prime, it's theta E on those slides. So what we end up with is, if we look just at this jam packing, is a scaling description of them, where we have three exponents and two scaling relations between them. But certainly there is a big riddle, because as was asked, what are the values? It still leaves 1 degree of freedom, so those exponents are not pinned. And therefore, you can ask questions about universality, the role of spatial dimensions. So at least in 2D and 3D, we didn't see any. And can we compute those quantities analytically? So that seemed like a very hard program, but there was a sort of very, very interesting result recently by Urbani, Zamponi, and Parisian co-workers, who were actually able to compute using their replica method that they developed for spin glasses and with Marc Mézard introduced for structural glasses. So they developed a technique to compute what's going on in infinite dimension. And what they find in infinite dimensions, so they can measure, they can compute G of H and P of F, the distribution of force. And they find those two exponents for gamma and theta. I mean, they have as many digits as they want. They don't have some kind of analytical expression for them, but they can compute with the desired precision. And what they find is that those actually do not satisfy what we predicted for the relation between gamma and theta. Because remember, those localized excitation are the most numerous, so their density actually controls P of F. Okay? And so they didn't find that their exponent satisfied this. But if they plug it in our relationship, then to the five-digit precision that they had, that satisfies exactly this relation here. So what it supports is that in infinite dimension, you don't get the sort of localized excitation. And you only get the extended one. Okay? So what's pretty remarkable is that this number, even if you look in 2D and in 3D, it's actually it's very good. So it could be, it's not yet clear presently, but it could be that, you know, it's even exact in 2D and 3D. We don't know, but it's close. Anyway, it's very close.
What makes this gamma or theta so complicated in infinite?
They don't even have an analytic, I mean, they can compute it with some, they have to solve some sort of boundary problem. I mean, they don't have an analytical expression for this exponent. So they can't really prove this equality, for example, but they can check that it's satisfied.
That's really for grains or for thermal particles?
So they look at jammed particles. So that's when the pressure diverges. So they have some way to try to capture something about the dynamics, and they can try to say something about what happens if you get different rates. And at all the rates at which they go, they find the same
exponent. But you have a finite temperature.
So they are looking at hard particles. So temperature, you know. It's just going to be, so they have a finite temperature, but then they have some protocol to say, to try to estimate what would happen if you are quenching at a given rate. Even if they're going really slowly, at some point they reach their ideal glass, and they would find all sorts of exponents. So even if they were not doing, if they were just doing the thermal thing without dynamics, at some point the ideal glass occurs at finite pressure, but they can still compress it and it will have this. I have to say that what happens technically, that Francesco for 10 years has been on this calculation, and it bear fruit recently because they realized that just like in Winfield spin glasses, the replica are broken, the symmetry between replicas are broken actually. And it's just a full symmetry breaking, just like for spin glasses. So there is some connection with spin glasses too. You have a sort of marginal stability for the density of local fields. All right, so that's all I wanted to say about the solid, and now I wanted to talk about the fluid. And that's more tentative. It's very risky. But so should I go on, or is it too late already? Or what? Okay, I will fasten your seatbelt, as you say. Okay, I can give you the tentative way of thinking about it. So it's a very hard problem, and we make some kind of assumption at the beginning, and from it we can compute things and compare it with data. We hope that it's correct, we're not sure.
Excuse me, Mathieu, if we go back, sorry, just to the jam state. Now, if you think of the infinite dimensional system, it means that in that case, all the jam states are indeed marginal.
Yeah.
There are no more stable states.
That's true,
right? So in that case, it's an answer to your question.
Exactly, but they don't have the crystal at all in their description.
Yeah, but at least there are no jam amorphous states.
Yes, no, for instance, so exactly. So in infinite dimension, just like for Minkowski spin glasses,
yeah,
you would find that indeed there are no more states of.
So that's one answer.
So that's at least exactly
in which your
that's,
statement.
That's true.
But in finite, there are no states in the avalanche.
Yeah.
No avalanche.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in yes.
But true. For example, in the spin glass case, we know that there are these very weird states and that just seem to be stable, but they're extremely marginal, so that, you know, dynamically they never end up there, but you can count.
But are there states that are,
I mean
if even the ground state that is probably is saturated in terms of
but these states are even they are like a small balcony on a cliff, like they never come up there, but if you're exactly there.
Well, yeah, but you never visit them dynamically because they're unstable, you mean?
Yeah.
Right, but that's a bit the other question would be, can I have even more stable states? And this, I think I agree with you, but I think in finite dimension, I would, if I had to bet, I would think that was crystal.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, so that's a problem we are going back to, and let me do it just in the viscous case, which is involved enough. So the problem is that here you have a driven system, and you have two questions. The first, the hardest one, I think, is how are you going to describe the structure of this? At a given packing fraction, how can you compute in such a driven system which states are actually visited? And that's where we'll do a wild guess, and then compare it with data. But first, here what I want to illustrate is that in this model, at least, it's the viscosity I told you about as a very simple geometrical interpretation. It's just proportional to if you want the velocity square of the particle. And that's for a very simple reason. That in those kinds of model, the drag force that are fed by particles is just of the order of the characteristic velocity or relative velocity between adjacent particles. Okay, so in real, so they would also need to have a discussion with real system where you have replication and you can have a divergence of the prefactor here. But people in the field think that actually you're making contact, and so that this divergence is cut off because you have roughness between particles. But here, we can again have this discussion after the talk, but here I'm just going to assume that, like many models which look at this, that you have a relationship between force and relative velocity. So then you can ask, I inject some power in the system and it has to be dissipated, and I can equate the two. Common that many of those have done, but sort of straightforward. So the dissipation then is at the level of a particle is the velocity times the force, so it's going to go like the velocity square. But if you think globally at the system, per unit volume, if you want, or let's say per particle, I got rid of the diameters of the particles entering here. So. But there is this power that's dissipated has to be equal to the power that you inject in the system. So that has to do with the applied stress and the strain rate. The applied shear stress is the viscosity times the strain rate squared, times the strain rate. So you have that the dissipation goes like this. So if you compare the two, you find that the viscosity is proportional to the velocity squared divided by the strain rate squared. I call this L squared. L is a lever effect. And this is defined as, if I look at my system and I doing some infinitesimal strain delta gamma, how much does the particle move? Okay? So if you want, I have a problem that's constrained by contacts. And this network of contact acts as a lever. So if I try to impose some strain at the boundary, the particle have to move more and more when I have more constraint. That's because a way to say that the floppy mode is the only direction in which the particle can flow, the number of floppy modes goes to zero. So in fact, you are imposing a shear, but the projection, the shear projected on the space of floppy modes gets smaller and smaller. So to actually perform a given shear, you need to move the particles more and more. I hope I'm making sense.
So the leverage for an affine transformation would be one.
Yeah. Good. So that would be what happens very far away from Jan. Okay. So right. So you have this lever effect, and so what we want to do is to be able to compute what is this L. How much velocities on displacement are on this? Okay, so that's what we need to compute. But to do that, we need to be able to say something on the structure, and that's very hard. Okay, so that's where we do our main assumption. And our main assumption is that we propose to think about flow as a perturbation around the solid. So what I mean is that imagine that this is a jammed state at the critical stress anisotropy. We propose to think about configuration visited in flow as similar to jammed configuration to which you would give a kick. By a kick, I make some additional stress anisotropy at the boundary. Okay? Some additional delta mu here. So what would happen if I take a jam system and suddenly I impose stresses and I increase this? Well, what's going to happen is that some of the contacts are going to become unstable, their force is going to vanish. And so some contacts are actually going to open. Okay? And actually the bumps will dilate. So what we are arguing is that those contacts that open are not going to be random contacts. They are the contacts that are very weak, and they are the contacts that couple to the boundary. In fact, you can show that this localized excitation, if I give a stress at the boundaries, they will not open. So the way we think about kinetics, about the flow, is as a sort of gas of those excitation. And by excitation, I mean this opening of very soft extended contacts.
So is that something you observe empirically, or is that something
that the philosophy that this is sort of guess, okay. And then we work through the consequence of this guess and compare with data. But so this is how we try to think about it. Okay, so let's think about the sort of gas of excitation. So I look at a jam system, and a way to rephrase what I'm saying is that you look at the jam system, and I'm going to suddenly remove some of those soft contacts that were extended. So one way to do it, the procedure to do it, would be to say suddenly I erode those particles here. So now I create a little gap between them, and I let the system flow. And the statement that the flow of such a system would be similar to the real flow if I drive it, right? So that's an assumption on the kind of microscopic structure that I'm actually visiting with flow. Okay, so it turned out that what's good with this way of thinking, that it can be made very predictive, I think. And in particular, here you can, I think, immediately compute what will be the lever effect, you know, the thing that gives you the viscosity, in terms of the coordination, how many contacts you remove. And again, what we're going to use is that, essentially what we're saying is that flow live close to reference state where force is not balanced. Some sense that we're saying. So think about the state just before I remove those contacts. Forces were balanced. So now I know that if forces are balanced, I actually, again, have this idea of virtual work theorem. So any displacement field that I can think of must satisfy, if the initial configuration was balanced, must satisfy that the work of external forces are equal to the work of contact forces. That's just a way to restate force balance. I'm going to use this theorem for the response that would occur for the displacement field in blue that would occur if I would remove the straight contacts and impose some strain. Okay? So now the work of the external forces is just going to be proportional to the volume of the box, the applied stress, and delta gamma. Okay? The work of the contact forces is all the, those contacts are going to stay close, but those contacts that I eroded are going to come closer to each other. Right? Now they have the ability to do that. So the only work of the contact forces come from those contacts here. So force balance in the initial state is constraining on the kind of displacement I can have when I cut contact. That's the statement. And it's constraining in this way that for the displacement that I will have, the work of the external forces on this displacement has to be equal to the work of the contact forces. Only those contacts that I remove will work. So that's the sum on alpha on those contacts, okay, in red. Now I make those delta r are just negative because the particles, once I erode them, are going to approach each other. So now I'm simply estimating this sum by the number of terms in the sum. Delta z is a fraction of contact that I opened. So this is the number of terms in the sum. And that's a typical value of each term in the sum. So there is a characteristic displacement, the characteristic relative displacement between particles, delta r, by which those two particles are going to overlap, and f is the characteristic force of the contacts I removed. So that's easy. If I know P of F and I tell you that you remove a fraction delta Z of those contacts, it's easy to compute what is this characteristic force. It's just proportional to pressure, that's just the scale of forces, but it will depend on delta Z on a non-obvious way with this exponent theta.
So you remove the weakest forces?
You remove the weakest forces, exactly. So essentially, the idea behind that is that when you have avalanches, I told you that the weak contacts are going to open. So we think about flow as a sort of big avalanche in the system.
I'm not sure what you mean by delta Z.
Delta Z is the number of contacts I'm going to remove. Which will bring function then, the next slide, I would argue that it's a function of the stress and etc. But it's I was isostatic and I remove a given fraction of contact, delta Z, and those are not random contact. They are those weak, soft contacts. And then what I want to compute is what is the lever effect, what is the geometry of the displacement in the geometry where I remove the weak contacts and I impose a shear. Right? So delta Z is this fraction of weak contact I remove. Next, I will have to tell you how delta Z depends on macroscopic parameters. Okay, but that's actually already a prediction that we can test right now. Okay, because numerically we can measure delta Z, the coordination of the network, and we can measure the viscosity.
I don't understand the relation between
the delta Z. Okay, so this is just okay, so this is just the scale of force. It's given by the pressure. So that's not the interesting part. So this is just because P of F goes like F theta E. So I'm just requiring that, you know, I'm removing the weakest force. So my characteristic force has to satisfy this. It's just a statement that I'm removing the fraction delta Z of the weakest force in the system. Yeah.
I don't quite understand why you have the assumption that the flow is breaking the weakest contact. I mean, you may have very weak contacts that are kind of protecting inside a cluster of hard contacts.
But it turns out that the localized molar is slightly like this. So the localized excitation I told you about are precisely like this. So there are precisely those that are not sensitive at all to what's going on.
Those are the ones that were marked with little X's, red X's in them.
Those I don't bring them in my description. Because my description is, Okay, so you have I have this localized contact coupled very weakly to the surrounding. So for example, you can show that if you take a system and you impose some applied stress on it, it's always the extended contact that will open first, and never the localized one. This you can show just because they have almost no coupling to the boundary.
Then I thought Jean-Louis' question was particularly relevant.
No, so here, what I'm cutting are those contacts that are actually related to extended floppy modes.
Yeah.
So actually, the displacement in response to that will be completely extended in the system.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if I was cutting the localized contacts, the displacement would just be purely a few local pairs of particles moving like this.
Identifying where the floppy modes are.
Yes, those are the extended weak contacts. So the response to this is going to be extended, and all the particles are going to move. But again, that's just precisely because of what you said, because those guys that are localized are protected from. So the way we try to, so actually this result that I have at the end, now we also managed to derive it in the way that maybe you would find more satisfying, which has to do with balancing collision, contact closing, and contact opening. And we also find actually the same schedule. But then what I wanted to tell you next, I don't know how to do it without this sort of assumption.
So the key assumption here is that somehow sigma and p are about the same? So they drop.
No, this is always, no, this is, a, okay, sigma and p are always, sorry, so always, that's always the same because, even, right, because they scale the same, sigma over p at jamming goes to a constant. So that's, so okay. They scale similarly, yeah.
Okay, now I see this criterion down in the lower right, valid up to delta z 1/(1/n), which
yeah.
Seems serious.
Yeah, so this I will come on, but let me first, I mean,
okay.
So what I'm doing is that I'm just comparing those two terms,
yeah.
And then I can compute delta r over delta gamma, and this is my Lepper effect that tells you for a given strain how much the particles are going to move. And with this argument, you predict a non-trivial dependence in delta z. So viscosity is going to be the square of that. So the viscosity will go like this to an exponent 2.
Thank you.
I can stop here and we can discuss. I mean, I can stop here, just show you that this. This prediction I just told you is tested here. So, and that's the most stringent of the prediction because you don't have any fitting parameter. Then I would have told you about stress anisotropy and packing fraction. Those two cases, those two quantities are, you know, sort of fitting parameters, are not exactly defined. So, but if you look at coordination versus, or here we look at the quantity that people look after, which is called the viscous number. You want the inverse of the viscosity in terms of scale. So we predict that this exponent, if you look in, put the numbers into this theta e, so it should be an exponent 3. And okay, so the curve is not perfectly flat, so we think you have strong finite size effect, but it works very well, I would say. And there is no fitting parameter there. So that's our prediction between q on the viscosity and the coordination.
So how do we see
it's the weakest modes that are breaking? Is there a way to see that? Well, I mean, maybe what I should say about our calculation is that, sorry, I wanted to say something. Sorry, I forgot what I wanted to say.
But
it's a sort of interpretation of what we said is that the lever effect, okay, I can tell you that if you were assuming that this scaling that we find is very different from the Nyquist scale, okay, because we looked a lot at non-affine displacement in elastic materials and thought that that would be enough to understand this. If you are taking a random network and changing the coordination and you're floppy, a random network would not have the same level effect at all. The explosion of the viscosity would be three times, the exponent would be three times smaller. So it could be ridiculously much smaller. So the fact that we have this result is not trivial, in the sense that you have some kind of self-organization in flow that makes the viscosity explode much faster than simple non-affine displacement. And I think what this argument captures, right, if you follow the argument, that's really the fact that you have a very large Lever effect. In fact, mathematically, it's very much related to the fact that forces in the network are much more balanced than if you would take a random network. And so I think our simple minded way to remove the weakest contact actually does capture this. This result I really think is correct, because we also have it by requiring that what we find in flow is that we can, at the end, we'll have to have arguments that are based on collisions, you know, purely dynamical and not assumed sort of. But what we do is that you have contacts forming and contact opening, right? But the balance has to be balanced. You need to have as many contacts forming than contact closing. And what we find is that actually contacts don't open spontaneously. Most of it with properties that goes to one, contacts open due to collision. So you have a collision and you open some contact elsewhere. So we developed a formalism for at least a simple model where we can also compute length scale. We call it the ASM, but it's a model by also McTighton. Well, simple damping. Then we can really compute what would be the effect of a collision on the surrounding. And if we require that the collision in average will open up the other one contact, we get the same result here. And really what happens in this calculation is that when you create one contact, it's like a force dipole that lives on a ball of a certain size, and it's going to couple to this extended weak contact and do now those that are going to open. So that's why I think this argument that gets the answer is actually correct.
Okay.
Yes?
Am I understanding correctly that this is entirely dependent on your mechanism, which is perfectly reasonable, for forming a system which is not going to give you just a random network? But your marginal stability and ideas are essential in figuring out which systems you're going to test.
Okay, so just a point that here I'm just looking about stationary flow, yeah. And that's the only statement I would like to make. Now there's a question in the audience that came up with about friction, so I can tell you I think it may still be relevant about friction.
You can do it later. But I think to answer Jim's question, I think random networks, they're force balanced.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying.
No, they're not, so that's the point of this, that they are not random at all, because a random network would give you viscosity that an exponent three times smaller. Yeah. So it's the same coordination.
Yeah, but then my only question is I want to make sure that, that I understand that this is determined by how you're preparing the system.
Well, yeah, I'm assuming some dynamics and a continuous shear forever, stationary state.
And you're assuming that this is going to come to something like this marginal stability state.
Once it's jammed, I can use my marginal stability argument, because it's this exactly the same when you have anisotropy, so I can prove that the jam state should, at the critical point, should also satisfy this.
My point is that is not going to come to the state that's just sort of random.
No, it's going to come.
That's the crucial.
Exactly, it's going to come. That's why we do a perturbation. That's why we do a perturbation around the marginal state.
Yes, that's exactly.
Exactly.
What I wanted to make sure I
understand. Exactly.
I think it's right.
Okay. So you're right. Sorry. A random network is not a random force balance network. It's a special force balance network.
That's right.
You're always considering extended and localized modes, but like you said at the beginning, there's a continuum in between.
Yeah.
Does this continuum is just make subdominant corrections to what you're...
In all our argument, it does. I have to say that the sort of descriptions that we're proposing, there is something I'm uncomfortable about, which is, it's true that if I think about collision, it's true that I will open only of this extended type of gas. And it's true that if you impose a shear, so the description that we propose is only based on those guys, and it seems to work. But what I feel I'm not comfortable about is that we still find that those localized excitations are marginal. Mm-hmm. And so it would suggest that they should also somehow be involved in the dynamics. Now, when we don't involve them in the dynamics, we seem to get a good result. So there is something that would...
Well, if you open one of these extended ones, there's no particular reason why it won't close at a localized one. Is that right?
Well, you mean the source. Yes, so that it, you mean that it could create a localized one.
When the avalanche ends, it can end at a localized one, which seems asymmetric. It seems like as you shear, you'll get rid of all your extended ones and they'll all become localized or something bizarre.
Yeah, so we would like to have a sort of, at the end, a full dynamical description of, in fact, contacts are, so that I have to remind myself, but. Yes, there's a sort of parameter associated to contacts that describes how much they couple to the surrounding. And this parameter can vary between 0 and 1. Say it's 1 for extended and 0 for, in fact, it has a continuous distribution. So one would like to write a sort of dynamical equation for this kind of parameter. So far, what we can do is a sort of simple assumption. So what I didn't have to tell you is that we can use similar argument for. So what we use as a guess is that delta z is going to be given by the number of contacts that break for a given delta mu, which we can also compute. And that's, okay, well, that's what we do here, but that seems also to give us a good scale. Here you have more leeway because mu c is not completely, it's not completely frozen. We argue also that mu scales like delta phi, like mu minus mu c scales like phi minus phi c, just by estimating how your object is going to dilate as you impose a given shear. And so it's all in this paper.
There's a good agreement between the simulation level, how many fitting parameters?
Here there is no fitting parameter.
Ki, for example, ki.
Okay, so here there is no fitting parameter?
Nothing.
Or theta e, I just take it to the one predicted by those guys, which is what I get to. And I can measure it.
Within your framework, you cannot determine.
Sorry?
Within your framework, I don't think that you can determine.
I just take the value that the guy with the replica, because it's the same. One is O.42, the other is O.44 or something. So it's very, very minor. So I just take that.
Yes.
And this I can measure it independently, so it's not a fitting parameter, right? So here when I do that, I have absolutely zero fitting parameter. But I agree that it's always good to compare with the rest of the world. So that's what I also wanted to. Okay, I didn't have time to tell that. But with those ideas, for example, you can predict that the viscosity diverges with an exponent at 2.83. I didn't have time to. So this is the one I told you about, but this means that it's our measurement. We're the only ones who have measured that. What we get for the explosion of the backing fraction, actually it's pretty good with the rest of the world in terms of exponent. The only outlier is Jean-Louis in the room here.
So this is two dimensions, three dimensions, or?
So we find, we even don't mention because they seem to be the same. The data reported in the literature are consistent in 2D and 3D. So in the table where we, in our paper we report all the data we are aware of. We also have one for the inertial flow, and it doesn't seem to depend on that.
Your number 2.83 is two dimensions?
No, it's the same in 2D and 3D.
Did you say?
Well, because we measure the same theta e, and the prediction of those guys,
okay.
And I just take the prediction of those guys, which seems to be very accurate in any dimension. So it's a fraction of 4 plus theta e, that's something like this. Okay, so now I can have.
But in experiments, there's friction.
Yeah, so I can have the discussion. So
I think we are getting a little bit over.
Okay, sorry.
Maybe can you conclude the.
Okay, so I will conclude on friction.
No.
I will just conclude one thing that real data have friction, And people report an exponent 2, where we report 2.8. So if it's really different or not, and here we claim in this fit that we can't know, because we, even with this exponent, we could fit exponential data on a rather big range. But I want to say something about friction, because indeed, no, because it's important, because you would, okay, so all what I told you about was based on isostaticity, and we know very well that if you prepare a packing of frictional particles, it's just not isostatic. So why are we talking about this? Are we looking at a very singular case? And these are the data that actually, so we're thinking hard about this. I have some more comments to make, but so when we look at the initial case, our theory compares, I think, very well with numerics that are frictionless, but it's completely off when you have friction. So at least we know that in the initial case, new thinking is required by friction. Now in the viscous case, it's not completely clear. Now, I don't necessarily think that the new thinking has to do with the business of isostaticity because of some numerics, but those, I think Wu also has some numerics that suggest that this is the case. And those are numerics by Crit, who is looking at frictional particles. And he's looking at this business of how many constraints you have, a distance to isostaticity. And he prepares his system isotropically. And then what he finds, like everyone else, is that when you prepare your packing, you find that actually it's hyperstatic. So if it's hyperstatic, it's just like regular materials, and a local strain will decay as a polo and things like that. But then you impose some strain. And this is a distance to isostaticity. Now, at some strain, the system breaks. And that's something that, for example, Jerome Weiss has studied a lot. When this thing breaks, it's still hyperstatic. And so I think the physics is much very similar when it breaks to elastoplastic models and what happens for soft for systems which are soft part. But if you continue flowing and you look at the stationary state, kind of the critical state, the state that you reach in the stationary state, what they find in their numerics is that the system tend to become isostatic, or at least very close to isostatic. So the hope is that after all, we're doing a perturbation around the stationary solid, that this solid may become isostatic. So maybe it's not completely a dream. Maybe when you quasi-statically flow a system, it has to become isostatic in some sense. Maybe I could say something about this, that it's different from plasticity. When you think about it, if you really have completely hard particles and you shear it continuously, you really have flow, you really must have some floppy modes that pervade the system. It's the only thing that can actually occur in the system. If you have a network of contact, if you have hard constraints, you must have some kind of floppy mode. Now, I think all description based on frictionless system is a sort of mean field description where those floppy modes live everywhere in the system. If you have friction, what we could not exclude is that maybe you have hyperstatic island, regions that are much more connected, and that flow occurs between those islands. It's localized, so that's not too different from elastoplastic models where you have the solid plasticity of oranges. So you could have a scenario where you have hyperstatic island and floppy modes in between, and if those islands get bigger and bigger as you approach jamming, then all description is probably not correct. It's probably just a mean field description or more complicated things that's going on. But these data suggest that actually you don't create those very big islands. And so maybe we have some good description, but we don't know.
Okay, I think we can.
Okay.